This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
You remember the Pesach Seder, the wise son asks the question, Mahachukim, Mahaedus, Vahachukim, Vahamishpotim, Asher Tzivah, Asher Melkech, Veschem. What are the Edus, the Chukim, and the Mishpotim? He divides the laws of the Torah into three categories. There are Edus, which are the laws that are time-specific, such as Yom Tov. There are Chukim, which are the laws that we would not keep if we were not instructed to do so. They're not irrational laws. No laws of the Torah are irrational, but they are laws which, had we not been instructed in the Torah, man himself would not have worked it out. Those are the chukim. So, for example, the law of not wearing a garment that is woven of linen and wool. We're not allowed to wear such a garment. That's a chok. We wouldn't have worked it out ourselves. We wouldn't have thought of it. Milk and meat, we wouldn't have thought. There are very good, logical, beautiful reasons why milk and meat is not permitted to be mixed together. Yet we would not have thought of it. We would not have prohibited it had we not been given those laws. Those are chukim. And mishpotim are the logical, rational laws that a society would keep no matter what. Theft and murder and things like that. Those are the mishpotim. Clearly, one of the most obvious mishpotim, one of the most obvious rational laws, is the fifth commandment. Kabeid es avicho ve'esimecho. Honor your father and your mother, leman yarichun yomecho al ha'adamah she'ashem elokech ha'nesein loch, so that you will have length of days on the land which the Lord your God has given you. And yet, we'll see this evening that in the piyut of Shavuos, the piyut are pieces of poetry that are inserted in the davening on a Yom Tov. Nowadays, most shuls don't say it anymore. There are very few shuls that still recite the piyutim. But they're beautiful, and they contain some very deep principles of Torah and of understanding of Torah, just veiled in the mystery of their verse. And one of them, is almost as an aside, just comments about kibud av'eim, the honoring of a parent, as a chok, as one of those laws that we would not have worked out ourselves. One of those laws that are beyond human reason. And that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, and this evening we'll begin to understand it. Now there is a Tana de Bei Eliyahu, which in the 26th chapter says the following. The fifth commandment appears on the right-hand tablet, so to say, the first tablet. And he seems to imply that part of the reason for that is because you read it as almost bracketed and leading into the other five. So it's written parallel to the other five, not sequential. So if you look at the list of the five commandments in the left-hand tablet as a list, then the commandments on the right-hand side of the tablets are embody everything that's on the left. On the left you have a list, and then on the right you have five principles that govern all of those commandments on the left. And the Tana de Bei Eliyahu says something very, very fascinating. He says, what is the first commandment on the left-hand tablet? Lo tirzach, I shall not murder. Ma inyan kabeid etzel lo tirzach. What has honoring a parent got to do with not murdering? El elamedecho, but it comes to teach you, im yesh lo odom mezoynes betech beso. If a man has food in his house, ve'inoy mechabeid v'zan u'mefanes es ovi v'zimoy, and he does not support his father and mother and give them of the food that he has, afilu bialduson, even when they're young, when tzorich lomar beitziknuson, and certainly when they're old, nechshav loy ki'ilu roet rutzeach kol yomov lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God considers him the same as a man who murdered all his life. That's how serious God views it. Not as he committed an act of murder. If a person doesn't support and sustain his parents from that which he has, God considers it not as an act of murder, but as a lifetime of murder. That's how God views it. The kachneima kabeid loytirzach. That's why honoring the parent leads straight into loytirzach, into the prohibition of murder. That's interesting. That still applies in certain societies. In Singapore at one time, and I'm not sure if it's still so, but it wasn't a very long time ago, it must have been about 15 years ago, that the first old-aged home was about to be built. And the Prime Minister, who, as you know, was quite a dictator, banned it, he forbade it. He wouldn't have an old-aged home built because he said then children are going to start delegating the support of their parents to institutions, and we'll lose the fabric of society. Children won't grow up with their grandparents, they won't see their children supporting their grandparents, the parents of those children, and will damage the fabric of society. And therefore he prohibited the construction of an old-aged home in Singapore, and I believe that's still the case today, that they've never built one in Singapore. And in many societies, in African societies, it would be absurd, it would be unheard of. They cannot understand what an old-aged home is, why I need an old-aged home. The Jewish community prides itself in South Africa of some of the most magnificent old-aged homes, and so they are. And the black community looks at it and says, but what do you need an old-aged home for? Where are the children? And why would you put somebody in a home? Why would you put a parent in a home? They can't understand it. The respect of an elder is something that goes without saying, and they would never, never, never put a parent into a home. That's just something they wouldn't do. So in most societies, it's in fact only in Western society, the parents, the children have kind of graduated from the need to take care of their parents, and will understand why that is. And in fact, if the principle of if this principle of supporting a parent and be considered murder if one didn't, then just look at the economic models would change also, because then you would invest all your money into educating your children, and you'd have as many children as you could, because that's your future investment, that's your retirement policy. You wouldn't take out money for retirement. So having to take out those two phenomena of modern Western society, this obsession with providing for one's retirement, working one's whole life to provide for one's retirement, you don't even know if you're ever going to get there, and if you do get there, well, it's unlikely to be enough by the time you do get there in any case, but this complete obsession with providing for your retirement is the function of children not regarding it as their, firstly, of not having enough children, but it's difficult. You have two children, and the two children have to take care of their own growing families and two parents. That's a heavy weight. But if you have eight or nine children, it's no big deal. Between the eight or nine children, they take care of the parents too. A parent would never have to worry about his old age, and he could work all his life for the future of his children. He could invest in his children, educate the children, send them to the best schools and universities, possibly set them up in business, because he would know that whatever he's investing in them is the future not only for them and their children, but also for himself. And it would make a lot more sense economically to be able to do that. We feel a dependence. We don't want to be dependent on our children. But the only time you don't want to be dependent is if you detect that there's a deep-seated resentment. One doesn't mind being dependent on somebody who delights in the dependency. You don't mind being dependent on somebody that you love and that loves you. A husband and a wife who love each other a great deal don't mind. Supporting one another, helping one another, it's reciprocal, and they understand that. There's no embarrassment in the dependence. And so it is in many relationships in life at different times. We don't mind dependence when we are certain, and we're talking about reciprocal dependence, not total dependence. And a parent is reciprocal dependence. All those years the parent took care of the child. It's only in later years, it's for a short period of the parent's life and a short period of the child's life, that the child might be called upon to support the parent. It's a very small slice of the child's life, normally. So it's totally reciprocal. And generally, we're okay about reciprocal dependence where there's love. It's odd that parents are not okay about becoming dependent on their children, even where it's reciprocal. Why not? Because the parents know very well the children don't want to do it. So there's something inherently flawed in the whole parent-child relationship, if that's the case. And it is the case. So as a result of that, the parents say, I don't want to have too many children because I've got to take care of my retirement. So, and I wouldn't have money to raise children. People wouldn't think like that if they didn't have to worry about their retirement. So they realize, I don't know how long I'll be able to work, something might happen, so I've got to put a whole lot of money away. So I've only got a small amount of money left to educate children, so I can only have a small number of children. And the whole economic cycle turns, instead of from a growing spiral, it turns into an ever-diminishing spiral. And you've got situations now in Western society where the young are too few to support the aged, and social security systems throughout the Western world are showing the signs of distress. That's a sign not only of an entire society, but it's a sign of a family too. But the proportions are wrong. Two parents should have 6, 7, 8, 9 children, and then you've got it okay if the children are willing to take on the responsibility of taking care of the parent, so the parent can invest everything they make in the future of the children. And the Talmud Beliyahu goes on and says, and what about Lotirah, the next commandment on the left hand side? To teach you that if a man has money, has material wealth, has the ability, and he does not honor and sustain his parents, it's as if he's committed adultery all his life. It's as if he's been unfaithful to family all his life. And what about theft? The third one on the left hand side? If he's got what to honor his parents with, and he doesn't use it to support him, to sustain his parents, it's as if he's been stealing all his life. It's taking something that isn't his, it doesn't belong to him. Your parents invested in you, you reciprocate at the time, and if you refuse to do so and you hold on to it, then you're holding on to something which doesn't belong to you. That's theft. And what about giving false witness? Same kind of thing. If you don't acknowledge the rights of your parents, the authority, the stature of your parents, as if you're declaring false evidence, as if you're denying them. And what about litachmud? You shouldn't want things that don't belong to you. If you don't support your parents, you've been living your life without taking cognizance of litachmud. You want things which are not yours. And so it goes on. It goes further also to say that when there is the honoring of the parent, then not only is it as if one has kept all the laws on the left hand side of the tablets, but as if one's kept all the laws of the Torah altogether. And that's quite odd, because we find, take Esav for example, the person who most exemplifies the mitzvah of honoring a parent. Nobody has ever honored a parent the way Esav did. Now, Esav is not a Jew. Esav was wicked, he was evil, and yet the Gemara tells us that nobody came near to the stature of Esav when it came to honoring parents. Yet we know he was a thief, and he was a murderer, and he was an adulterer, he was a bad man. So what's the connection? How can the Talmud Beliyahu suggest that there's some kind of linkage, that if you honor your parents, you're not doing this, if you're doing that, you're not doing that? What is the linkage? And that question is asked even more forcefully by Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler was the Mashgiach in Ponovitch Yeshiva until a few decades ago. Before that he was in Gateshead. He has children who run the Jewish schools in Cleveland today. One of the outstanding thinkers of our time. And he poses the question and says, we see today that there are people who have moved right away from anything Jewish, and they're not even good civilians, they're not even good to one another. They've abandoned religion, and they've abandoned the humanistic rules and laws of one person to another. They steal, and they do all sorts of terrible things, and yet they are enormously respectful to their parents. You see such phenomena. Think of the Godfather. Okay, there's a society where there's an abandonment of all moral principle except one law, respect the parent. And Rav Dessler goes through and says there are many societies where we see this, where there is a complete loss of all sense of morality, but a great deal of emphasis on that one law, respecting a parent. What could the reason possibly be? And he develops an idea which is the Jewish equivalent, the Torah equivalent, of the idea that I quoted to you last week in the name of Lawrence Harrison, that the radius, that there's such a thing as a radius of trust. Radius of trust is a society can be measured by how far the trust goes out. Do you trust only the people in your family? Do you trust the people in your community? Do you trust the people in your country but not foreigners? What is the radius of trust? So you've got to look not only at the intensity of trust, but you've also got to look at the radius of trust. And Francis Fukuyama, in a very recent book, works out that there's an inverse relationship between the radius of trust and the intensity of trust. That the more intense the trust, the lower, the smaller the radius. So in the mafia, you'll have incredible trust for one another and zero trust for anybody else. And he gives examples of different societies. In Chinese society, you'll find enormous trust within the family and zero trust outside of the family. The family is very extended. It's cousins and uncles and aunts. It goes very far. But it's within the family. But outside of the family, there's no trust at all. And similar examples in some of the Mediterranean and South American countries, he says, where one will find a great deal of family trust, but very little trust outside of that. And Rav Dessler Harrison and Fukuyama did get to this by studying societies and measuring. In Torah, we get to these things from the Torah. We don't have to do surveys, since God created the world and God tells us how the world operates. And God told us that Fukuyama is right, that the radius of trust and the intensity of trust are inversely related. And one of the examples this is based on are five things the Gemara in Psochim says that Canaan commanded his sons. Canaan, remember, was the son of Ham, Noach's grandson. Ham was the one who disgraced his father. Ham was the one who showed no respect for parents. And Canaan was his child. And they went to Africa. Whether the Africans of today are descended from them or are not descended from them, there's a whole lot of discussion and various different views as to whether it's valid to assume that they did or they didn't. But they went to Kush, they went to Ethiopia, and then they worked their way through Africa, and some of them went out to the Far East. So that there is a general view that Africa and China, and possibly some other places now as well, are heavily descended or have a great deal of Ham influence in their genetic heritage. But what did Canaan say to his sons? Ahavu ze, love each other. Rule number one, he gave them five rules. Love each other. Ahavu es hagezel, love theft. Ahavu es hazimo, love immorality. Sinu es adoneichem, despise your masters. Ba'al tadabru emes, and don't think you have to say the truth. Those are the five principles. Ask Rav Dessler, this is a pretty bad nation in that case. Whoever they are, they're pretty bad. Love theft, love immorality, hate your master, don't talk truth. Where does love one another fit in there? It's just completely incongruent. Loving one another is a moral principle. So out of the five laws he gives them, four are entirely degenerate, and one is chesed. One is the golden rule of the Torah. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love one another. Explains Rav Dessler, when gangsters get together, they have to have a bond of brotherhood, because they have to be able to trust someone. And if they can't trust each other, their lives will be very short. So that it is a requirement of gangsterism to have a very close, a small radius of trust, but a very intense radius of trust. That's an actual requirement. So it's not, and here Rav Dessler would disagree with Fukuyama, it's not that where there's a deep trust, there's narrow radius. It's where there's narrow radius, there's deep trust. If you can't trust other people, you'd better have total trust in the gang. And that's the principle on which gangs work here, and that's why the police can't get their hands on top of gang warfare in this very city. Because the trust within the gang is so enormous and so difficult to break. Why is it so? Because there's no radius of trust beyond the gang. Where there's a small radius of trust, says Rav Dessler, there has to be an intense level of trust. There has to be a very deep, deep level of trust. And in that case, the loving of one another is not based on morality at all. The loving of one another is self-protective. That's all. The only reason they love and support one another is because they'll get into a lot of hot water if they don't. In that case, explains Rav Dessler, the same applies to honoring a parent. Every individual worries about his old age. and economics alone aren't sufficient. People worry about loneliness in old age. People worry about abandonment in old age. People worry about illness in old age. And the one thing is to try and provide money so that one has the ability to cope with that. So that's one important element. But there's a lot more than that. And one of the guarantees for old age is children. But an individual knows, my children had better see me honoring my parents if I expect them to honor me one day. And so a narrow radius of trust beyond the family. If a person says, my community will take care of me, if we take care of each other's aged, that's what we do, it's a communal thing. If that were the case, then there wouldn't have to be such a fear within the family itself. So let us take the observation that I made. If you take African society, or you take Chinese society in Singapore, there is no old-aged home, and they see that as a greater morality. We'd take care of our own parents. We would never put them into an institution. The Jewish world takes pride. We have old-aged homes, we have hospitals, we have old-aged homes. Which is the more moral, to have an old-aged home or not to have an old-aged home? If you have a small radius of trust, then you have to be able to trust internally. It's because those societies cannot rely on the community to take care of their aged, but they have to rely on the family. Because what would happen if there was an old-aged home in Singapore or in Africa? Who would fund it? Who would give money to it? How do Jewish old-age home work? Not the American model, because in the American model they're businesses. But in other Jewish communities they're not businesses. They're acts of charity. They're supported voluntarily. Most of the people who are there don't pay a penny. They can't pay. They're supported by the community. Can you imagine the Singapore community supporting old-aged homes? No. Can you imagine the community of Nairobi or Kinshasa supporting the Kinshasa old-aged homes? No. There are no charitable institutions. The families are charitable within themselves. But the communities don't have institutions unless they're funded by the United States. The only charitable institutions you'll find in Africa are those that are funded with foreign aid. The only charitable institutions you'll find anywhere in the world in the developing countries are those that are funded with foreign aid. Because they don't do that. They invest their charity in their own families because the radius of trust is small. The community doesn't support one another. The family supports one another. And that's all. So for us, when the Jewish community says we have an old-aged home, that doesn't mean we're going to send all our parents there. It just means if a family cannot take care of its elders, there is a place that will take care of them. That's expanding the radius of trust. That means we trust each other. We trust that there'll be money for it even if we don't have a need for it. That means there'll be a trust where there'll be money for it even if we couldn't possibly have a need for it. Because there's a wide range of a radius of trust within the community. And so a Jew does not have to honor his parents for protective purposes. Because a Jew living in a true Jewish community would know that if I become old and my parents don't want to take care of me, there are plenty of others who will. The same as we've taken care of others in the community, that's not an issue. They're institutions, they're places, they're organizations, they're people. I'm not going to be alone. A Jew isn't alone. He isn't alone, no matter how old he is, how sick he is, how ill he is. If he's part of a community, he's not left alone, if we have a real Jewish community. A Jew does not need to practice the honoring of a parent to impress a child with the value, to ensure that that child will observe the value when the parent becomes old himself. That's not necessary for the Jew. So there's an enormous distinction in the honoring of a parent in societies with small radiuses of trust, compared to a society with a wide radius of trust. If you have a wide radius of trust, there's a different reason why you honor a parent. We'll see that. If there's a narrow radius of trust, you honor the parent because the parent took care of you when you were a child. Now you've got to take care of the parent now, so that when you're an old person, your child will say, he took care of me. When I was a child, I'll take care of him. It's reciprocal. It's chesed. It's absolute chesed. We're not suggesting for a moment that because it has an ulterior motive, it's not kindness. Of course it's kindness. And it's a wonderful thing to be doing. But it's kindness driven by the need for protection. It's kindness driven by expedience. It's reciprocation in order that the reciprocal relationship will continue into the next generation. And that's valuable, but that's not Jewish kibbutz avayim. That's Esav's kibud aveim. That's a different kind of kibud aveim. It's a different kind of honoring a parent. The Jewish honoring of a parent operates on a different level, and that in fact is chok. That in fact is statute. That in fact is beyond reason. If the Torah wasn't given, we would honor our parents the same as the black people of Africa honor their parents. If the Torah wasn't given, we would honor our parents the same as the Chinese in Singapore honor their parents. Sure, we would honor our parents. That's the rational law of honoring a parent. But the Torah law of honoring the parent elevated above that and says a society needs to do that even if there isn't a reciprocal relationship, even if there isn't the fear of one's own old age. This is a different principle altogether. What is the principle here? The principle here, the Ramban explains, and I want to read a bit of it to you. At the end of the fourth commandment, the one before this, Shabbos, says the Ramban, Hishlim kol ma she'anu chayovim b'divrei habore b'atzmoi u'bichvodo. We have completed in the first four commandments those laws that relate to our honoring of God. V'chozal tavois esonu b'inyone hanivroi. And now the Ten Commandments starts dealing with interpersonal laws. V'yitchil min ha'av, and the first one is the parent. Shehu l'todo sov ki inyan borei. Because the father is to a child like God is to humanity. Mishtatev b'yitziro, a partner in the act of creation. And that's the element of fatherhood, of parenthood, that the Torah tries to impart to us in this fifth commandment. Ki Hashem avinu harishon, because God is our primary father, v'hamolid avinu acharon, and our biological father is our secondary father. And therefore the Torah is telling us here in the Ten Commandments, just as I instructed you to honor me, I'm instructing you to honor he or they who participated with me in your creation. The Torah doesn't go into explanations, but clearly we learn this honor from that honor, and all the laws that apply to God should apply to a parent as well, and a whole lot more. And in fact, that's why the fifth commandment finds its place on the first tablet and not on the second. The second tablet deals with all the interpersonal laws, and the fifth commandment, which is an interpersonal law, honor your father, finds itself on the first tablet, not on the second tablet. If the honoring of the father was a rational law, if it was a mishpat, it would have to be on the second set of tablets, together with thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. Those are all the mishpatim. Those are all the rational laws. By placing the law of honoring the parents in the first category, the first five, clearly we're seeing that this is part of the man-God relationship, not only the man-man relationship, it is the transition from man-God relationship to man-man relationship, and it's classified as chok. So what is the process? The process is we owe God. God is our creator. And we owe God, and he took us out of Egypt and all of that, so we owe God. And then the process goes beyond that. And so if we owe those who facilitated our being, then we owe our parents too. Not because of the things they gave us and they took care of us. You don't need the Torah to tell you that. Your parents educated you and they fed you and they clothed you and they took care of you. So you owe them something back. There needs to be a reciprocation. We don't need the Torah for that. Africans know that. Chinese people know that. That's not Jewish. There's nothing Jewish about that. That isn't why God gave us the Torah. That isn't why God gave us the Ten Commandments. What is the element that gets added in the Ten Commandments that man would not have known by themselves otherwise? That is that this is a man-God relationship. You honor a parent because he participated in your creation. Now, what aspect of our creation did he participate in? Does a little baby monkey have to honor its parent ape? The ape participated in his creation. Is the law of honoring a parent a natural law that applies to the animal world too? No. This is human. Why would that be? clearly, when we talk about that the parent is a participant in the act of creation, it's not just our physical well-being that comes from the parent. That's a biological process that happens in the animal world, and people get together and they make children, and that you don't have to have a whole debt of gratitude, because a mother and a father got together and had a good time and a child resulted from that. That's not what it's all about. Parent is a shutuf, the parent is a partner in the spirituality of the child too. The child wouldn't have a neshama, the child wouldn't have a soul without the parent. The parent gives the child that soul together with God. It's not only from God, the parent is the channel. So when we're honoring the parent, we're honoring the parent not for the money the parent invested in us, that's a different law. Not for the education the parent gave us, that's a different law. We're honoring the parent for life, for spiritual life, for the fact that the parent gave us the key to spiritual growth. The parent gave us the capacity to combine a soul into our body and to live as real human beings. That's what we honor the parent for. And it's in that role of the parent as partner of God that we honor the parent. And that's a chok. That's not something we would have figured out. That's not something we would have known. Now, what impact does it have? What difference does it make? What the reason for which we honor the parent? There are two words for inheritance. The one is Yerusha and the one is Nachala. Two different words the Torah uses. Sometimes it uses the word Yerusha and sometimes Nachala. The Gemara in Kiddushin says a non-Jew, the laws of Yerusha apply to non-Jews as well. It's not specifically Jewish. The child inherits from a father, that's a universal law. The Gemara in Yevamos says the laws of Nachala do not apply to a non-Jew. So clearly there's a difference between Nachala and Yerusha. Although they're used almost interchangeably, clearly there's a fundamental difference between those two words. And Hirsch explains some of that difference in saying that the word Yerusha comes from the word when Yerusha means inherit, but it also means when God instructed the Jewish people on getting into them when they came into the land of Canaan to chase out, to dispossess the inhabitants, and the seven nations of Canaan. God uses the word virashtem oisom. You shall dispossess them. Says Hirsch, there is an element of inheritance that implies dispossession. Nachal comes from the word nachal, which is a flow. A river is a nachal. And these are completely different concepts. And he says there is a perception that youth can have of dispossessing the elders. That the future is the youth, that it's the energy of the youth, and that there's a dispossession of the elders to make the elders redundant as soon as possible. And there is another view of elders, of Nachalo. They are the source of knowledge, they are the source of wisdom, and wisdom flows from them to ourselves. Two different cultures, two different civilizations. There are civilizations that see the succession of generations as Yerusha, and there are generations that see there are civilizations that see the succession of generations as Nachala. If you see the succession of generations as Yerusha, you see youth dispossessing the elders. If you see Nachala, you see youth continuing and going beyond the elders, but drawing on what the elders are nourishing them with, the wisdom that the elders are nourishing them with. And we see a lot of that today, though, particularly in the age of technology, where for the first time the wisdom of the elders is almost irrelevant to the lives, or to the major section of the young people's lives. It's true that if the young people were studying art and literature and philosophy and religion, then the elders' knowledge would be very valuable. And even until recently, when people were not doing that, when people were in business and in the other professions, the knowledge of the elders was still incredibly valuable. And there was a case in South Africa just when the MBAs started being produced, and they started being produced at a rate faster than America could consume them, and so they started exporting them, and one of the countries they exported them to was South Africa. And it was quite difficult, because in South Africa at that time most businesses were family owned and family managed. So the first thing that had to be done is the business schools had to persuade the families that there's such a thing as professional management, that your son is not necessarily the best manager. So let your son keep his shares, but get him out of the business and hire an MBA and let him take care of the business. And I remember as a child, one of the largest companies of that in South Africa was owned by a very fine Jewish person. I was talking to my father, and he told him the story of how he did just that. He fired all his children, and he fired all his older managers who'd been there for years and years and elevated through the company, and he hired a squad of MBAs from America. And he said, you cannot believe how that company flourished. It just grew at phenomenal paces. And then came a recession, a major recession. And the MBAs panicked. They didn't have a clue what to do because they'd never seen a recession before. They'd never experienced it. They'd never seen, they didn't have any kind of masseurs of what you do when you need to make a sudden reversal. And he was one of the companies that recognized it quickly enough and fired all the MBAs and rehired all the old people at the salaries of the MBAs, and he turned his company around once again, whereas many others suffered. And he said that he realized they were positioned to take advantage of a buoyant economy, but they weren't positioned to deal with the experience needed in an economy in distress. But today that might not be so anymore. Today things are so different and so new that it's possible that experience is a serious disqualification. If you're going to try and treat a recession now using your experience from 1929, you're in trouble. Because it isn't the same, it's different. And one has to understand that it's different. So it's possible that for the first time we have a situation where in the area that people are most occupied, age has no advantage. No advantage. It used to have some advantage. It's possible that today it has no advantage. So we're now dealing with a generation that looks at its elders as a generation who needs to be dispossessed because they have nothing to contribute. So not only are we looking at now the possibility or the existence of a younger generation that abandons its older generation, there is the danger, it hasn't happened yet, but there is the danger that the future young generation will not only abandon its elders but consciously dispossess them, delink themselves from them and get rid of them in any way they can, because they will see them as a relic of the past that holds them down when it doesn't understand. For the first time, the knowledge, the young person, the 20-year-old, has a level of knowledge that far exceeds anything that his parents or grandparents could possibly have in the areas that are most important to his progress today. And so we're looking at a civilization today that focuses on Yerusha, on the passing down of one generation to another using the mechanism of dispossession. But the approach of the Torah is Nachama, that at no time are we allowed to do that. And we need to understand that no matter what there is that is technologically so innovative that older people have difficulty grasping it, there are still certain fundamentals in the world that remain unchanged. And those fundamentals only the older people can teach. Only the older people have the tradition and the source of knowledge that are able to transmit that to new generations. And that's the principle of Nachal. So whereas there is a universality to the law of honoring a parent, that universality applies to certain aspects of the law, but there is a uniquely Jewish component, which is the Chok component, elevating the law beyond that which would be normally rational, which we would normally reason, and saying, this is part of our relationship to God. This is recognizing that the parent is a channel of spirituality. And that we go looking for at youth and among youth for innovation and technology makes sense. But if we're looking for spirituality, and it's interesting that in this time of technological innovation there is such a desperate search for spirituality, where should we be going for the spirituality? We should be knocking on the doors of our elders. My brother told me that he once sought out an elderly musical conductor living in Los Angeles. I don't remember who it was, but it was somebody who was incredibly famous and highly thought of in his time. And he found him and he went to, if anybody knows the story, they might know who we're talking about. Do you know who it is?
Polanski.
Sorry?
Polanski,
who
was about 92 years old or something.
I don't remember who it was, but he went and he found this fellow out. And there he was, sitting on his own in his house, nobody around him. And my brother phoned and asked if he could come and see. He didn't say yes, in 3 weeks' time I've got a slot. He said, sure, come whenever you want. Like when? Like now. Fine. Tomorrow, whenever you want. And really, the time is sure. My brother felt very honored that this man had made such time for him. When he got there, he realized that the reason he could come any time is because he had nothing to do. And he said to him, don't young musicians seek you out? Don't people come and ask you, how do you interpret this, and what is your tradition, and how are you different from the way we're interpreting it today, and what were your experiences? Don't they want the stories? Don't they just want you to tell you your life experiences, what it was like in your time, and the different things you had to cope with, and what it was like building up orchestras the way you did? Does nobody come to ask you those questions? He said, no. My brother said, in our tradition it doesn't work that way. You've got an elderly rabbi, he hasn't got a moment in the day. The young students are there, the young students, little students, 15 and 16 year olds, never mind, the 20 and the 25 year olds, and the 30 and the 40 year olds, are there at the feet of the 80 and 90 year olds, because they realize they have something that no young person can possibly have, and to try and get as much of it as they can, and access it, the nachalo, passing the stream down, accessing that. That old person doesn't feel redundant. Different cultures, in a culture of Yerushal, when a man retires, he passes into extinction. In a culture of Nachalo, when a man retires, he achieves the status of an elder statesman, of a leader, of a wise sage that still has so much to give, not physical energy, but so much wisdom to give, that people need to take and do take advantage of it in that particular culture. Hirsch says that honoring a parent goes beyond honoring, because the Torah says in Kedoshim, it's worded slightly different. There it says, Ish imay v'oviv tiro, each man shall fear his mother and father. And he explains that tiro does not really mean fear, it's not the right word. Tiro means, from the word ro'o, to see. It means, see your parent even when they're not there. That's what it means. Which means what the obligation is not just to respond in a respectful way to a parent when the parent is present. But the mitzvah of honoring a parent applies also when the parent is not present. How do you do that? And that is by fulfilling the will of the parent. And Torah goes on to say, "Ve'eshav soisai dishmoru," but keep my Shabbos. You don't have to listen to a parent who tells you to do something wrong, who tells you to do something that is against the Torah. But barring that, if the parent has a certain will that doesn't compromise you, and even in some cases where it does compromise you, the requirement of Ishis or Imoy V'Oriv Tirol is that you see their presence and respond to their will even when they're not present. Parental will. And Hirsch says that from the point of view of a child, he says, it is in this chapter of Kedusha that that aspect of the child's duty toward its parents, that in the very first place is obedience that is stressed. A child's obedience to his parents. Why is that important? The overruling of the will of the parents over its own will, the cheerful yielding of its own will to that of the parents, is the first, earliest, and most lasting school of practicing self-control, which leads young human beings out of the life of enforced obedience to one's urges, into mastery over one's passions and impulses, into freeing the godly element in man, into that model freedom, the achievement of which constitutes the character of Kedusha. What is her saying? He's defining Kedusha as the ability to liberate oneself from obedience to one's own urges, to being able to be obedient to a higher urge. And where does a child begin to learn that? And it's interesting, it's about actions, there is a compulsion. The first thing a child needs to learn is to shift the source of compulsion from himself to something outside of himself. Parent. So the young child at a very young age begins to understand the concept of self-control. But although I want to do this, I can choose not to do it because there is a will outside of me that says no. And that says Hirsch is the beginning of Kedusha, that's the beginning of sanctity. The moment a child learns to do that, the child opens itself to the possibility of sanctity. I want to break Shabbos, but Hashem says, no, let me understand God's will. And honoring a parent, Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz always used to explain, doesn't mean blind obedience. It means reasoning with the parent, understanding the parent, understanding the value system from which that instruction comes, understanding the cultural background from which that value system comes. That's part of what it is. It's not just blind obedience. And that's how the child inculcates and imbibes that culture. And it's a source of enormous distress to me to see in our own community the extent to which parents do not enforce will on children. The extent to which children run amok. And it applies, you might ask, at what age does that begin? At what age do you think it begins? What age should a child start sensing the existence of an external authority? Birth. That's what changes at birth. Before birth, there's no outside authority. The child is taken care of, and that's it. The child's whole world is his own enclosure. That's the shock of birth. All of a sudden, there's a world out there. All of a sudden, you can't eat whenever you want to. In the womb, the child eats whenever it needs to, whenever it wants to. The first thing that a child parent does, or should do, to teach the child that you are now needing to adjust to a different system where your will is not the only determinant, in fact it might not be a determinant at all, is in the feeding process. Getting the child to understand that there's a routine. There's a cycle. This is the time. This is not a time. That doesn't mean you starve a child, but that means as quickly as possible you start getting the child into an understanding that there's a routine. That there's a night time and there's a daytime. There's a time to sleep and there's a time to be awake. And I know there are babysitting problems, but the damage that is done to the children, the schlepping of the children to weddings, and the schlepping of the children to social occasions, and the little babies, and they schlep here, and their child doesn't know day or night or anything. It doesn't begin to understand that there's a routine, there's an awake time, there's an asleep time. There's a time when you can disturb a parent, there's a time when you cannot disturb a parent. And how do you teach that to the child? Child starts crying in the middle of the night, little baby, infant, starts crying in the middle of the night, what do you do? Doesn't mean that you leave the child alone. But the mother's relationship to the child should be different, not one of cuckoo, cuckoo, let me entertain you until you fall back to sleep and I'll rock you until you get tired again. There needs to be a sense of sternness. This is not a time to be crying and to be waking everybody up. Now let's see, do you need something to eat? Here it is. Do you need your diaper changed? Here we are. Get back to sleep. I want to sleep too. There needs to be a sense, the child starts sensing that mother reacts with a different kind of sense at night from daytime. That mother is also tired. The mother doesn't want to be disturbed. And you know how quickly a baby can learn? A child can learn a language. Do you know how difficult it is to learn a language? How many of you in your adulthood have ever mastered a second language or third language? How many of you? A child can learn a language like that. That's how brilliant a child is. We lose that brilliance very quickly. But there is nobody, that never in our lives are we as brilliant as we are as an infant. So it doesn't take very long. And when I say very long, I mean days, a couple of weeks maybe, for the child to get the message. This is different. And then the parent becomes authority. And one carries that on through. Child says, I want to go home. We're sitting in shul. The child says, I want to go home. I've had enough of shul. Parent says, all right, I'll take you home. Destroy the child. Destroy the child's moral capacity. Destroy the child's religious capacity. Destroy the child's capacity for sanctity. You're in shul, and you're destroying the child's capacity for sanctity. Child sitting down wants to run around the shul. Why do I stop when people run around, when kids run around when I'm talking? Because I want to embarrass the kids? No. For two reasons. Number one, it disturbs the people who are trying to listen. But more important, where are the parents? What do you mean your child wants to run to the bathroom? Wait. And next time you'll know to go to the bathroom before the rabbi speaks. Or before the Shemona Esra starts. We were little kids, we weren't allowed to leave our seats in the middle of Shemona Esra while the chazan was doing a Chazoras Hashatz during Kedusha while a rabbi was speaking. So how long do you think it took us to start seeing ahead a little bit and realizing if we need to go to the bathroom, better turn the next few pages of the Siddur, see how far we are from the Shemona Esra, and better go now rather than later, because my father will give me such a look if I go later. I won't do it. Doesn't take long, and the child starts realizing there's a system, there's a discipline, there's an authority, there's a parent, there's a community, there's a God, there's a Torah. That's the process. And I'll say something I wish the tape recorders would be off for. Shall I turn them on? Why is it even in this shiur, even little things like getting up in the middle of the shiur, some of you might remember in the beginning when we start, in the middle of the shiur, people are wandering around, helping themselves to drinks, coming back, sitting down, in and out. Why did we stop it? And you've all responded magnificently to that. Not only because it's terribly disruptive and disturbing to people, of course it is. But there's something else, just the ability of understanding the appropriateness. There's a time one does and there's a time one doesn't do. And even though you feel like it, even though you're thirsty, there's such a thing as saying, I'm thirsty, and I can wait another 40 minutes. I'm not going to die, I'm not going to faint. I'll manage another 40 minutes. We're so used to satisfying our urges on the impulse. Why are we used to it? Because our parents allowed us to. And we're doing the same to our children. We're destroying their capacity for moral growth. That's something so destructive that we do. That's honoring a parent. How can we expect children to honor us? What should they honor us? They honor, we're playmates. We're our children's playmates, that's all. And the only time we become disciplinarians is when they irritate us. And the Vilna Gaon says that's the one time you're not allowed to be a disciplinarian. You're not permitted to discipline a child when you're irritated. Because that's not education. That's bullying. That's anger. That's vengeance. And you're not allowed to take it out on a child just because you're irritated. You're irritated, go and get rid of your irritation. Go and swim or punch a bag or do whatever you need to do. Come back and educate the child afterwards. We should educate the child long before we get irritated. Because the reason we're doing it is not to prevent irritation. The reason we're doing it is to provide a context for a child to learn the ability to say no, the ability to be disciplined, the ability to feel uncomfortable but still to sit through. ADD, what is ADD? I am sure that there are people who have a chemical problem and have ADD. I'm sure there are. I'm sure that some of the people who have a chemical ADD problem have it from birth. They're born with it. And that's a problem that needs to be dealt with medication. But what percentage of children are on Ritalin? I think it's the 60s and 70% in most schools. Yeah, very, very, very high. Very, very high. Unless it's gone down again recently. Very, well over the 50s. Well over the 50s. The children at certain stages of their development are on Ritalin. ADD is simply a child who didn't have parental guidance. That's a child who was never made to sit through a shul service. That's all. A child who was never made to sit down because their adults talking to sit through a meal. I want to go, I've had enough already, can I go and play? Yes, little one, you can go and play. No. You sit. But I'm bored. Learn how to sit when you're bored also. Because if you can learn how to sit when you're bored, you won't have ADD. You'll be able to sit and you'll be able to listen to a teacher even though you're bored. And you know what? Once you're sitting and listening, you won't get bored anymore. But if every time you're bored, you run out of the room, you're never going to learn anything. Because every time you have difficulty understanding something, you'll turn off, become bored, and feel you're justified to quit because you're bored. Boredom is not a reason to move. Boredom is not a reason to quit. There are other ways of dealing with boredom. Boredom is a symptom of other things that need to be done. Maybe there are certain changes that have to take place, and maybe it is the teacher that is not engaging the child. But deal with that, not with a bottle of Ritalin. That's not the answer. We've created ADD. We've created a restlessness. We've created an incapacity to be able to say to ourselves, I'm uncomfortable, but you know what? It's not yet time to go. I've just got to sit. I need the bathroom, but I can wait a little longer. I'm thirsty, but I can wait a little longer. Our children don't learn how to do that. I'm thirsty, I want to drink. I'm bored, I want to go out and play. And the parents crumble. The parents totally crumble because they're scared. They don't want to be unpopular. God forbid, the child might not like the parents. And in our society, as we discussed on Friday morning and at the ladies' show on Friday, in our society there is nothing worse than, God forbid, being unpopular. People lose their jobs if they're unpopular. Presidents get trounced out of office if they're unpopular. Can't live and be unpopular. So you've got to do what the electorate wants you to do. What the customer wants. And my child is my customer. I wouldn't want him not to like me. And so the one thing we're meant to do for the children, we don't do. In pursuit of our own popularity. And the child grows up with a deficiency. The child grows up with a moral deficiency and an intellectual deficiency that we have to take responsibility for. So honoring a parent is not just a law of the child towards the parent. The parent wants the child to fulfill the fifth commandment. He'd better be worthy of that fifth commandment. And he'd better be able to lead a relationship with that child that entails one of understanding, not despotism. We're not talking about cruelty. There are many laws in the Torah that guide a parent as to how not to be cruel and how not to be dogmatic. And how not to insist on something just for the sake of exerting power. That's the other extreme. There have been parents, and there are cultures and societies where parental authority is used as an opportunity for control instead of self-control, for the imposition of control and for mastery and domination. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a balance. Being able to use one's mind is to decide when it's time to be firm, when it's time to give in, when the child has a valid point and you can point out, you know what, you're right. You don't have to sit through this. It's not right for you. But there are other things you do need to sit through. Being able to find that balance, the parent, the child can look at a parent and learn yiro, can learn what it is to respect the will of an authority outside of himself, and can learn kibud avein, can learn the ability to treat the parent as the channel of God's law from God to the child, the channel of God's soul from God himself to the child, and can respect the parent as he respects God, honor the parent as he honors God, and build a society that is structured and built on understanding of the wisdom of the elders, understanding of the experience of the elders and the source of knowledge of the elders, valuing that, taking it with one into the future, taking the gems of the past and exploring the future with those gems and investing them in the future, passing on to our own children the principles and values, including kibud av va'em, that we ourselves gain from our parents. Thank you.